welcome everybody to the Aris Meyer podcast. I am joined today by a very special guest. He is someone that I've known all 37 years of my life, minus two. And his name is Jove Meyer. How you doing, Jove?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. This is a very highly requested guest by my listeners, and I have the pleasure of being in person with him. Jove, tell me a little bit about your life.
I mean, you know everything about my life.
I know everything about your life, but the listener doesn't know. Where were you born?
I was born in Orange, California.
Orange, California. And Tell me a little bit about your childhood. What was it like? Where did you go to school? What kind of friends did you have?
I was born and raised in a very small beach town in Southern California with one really lovely older brother. And four younger half-brothers, and four, right? Four plus two is six.
Wow. Yes.
Okay. Sorry. Math is not my strong suit. We were born and raised there, and it was a very interesting childhood. Mm-hmm. We grew up, as you know, in a very interesting religion, a unification church known by some as a cult. I spent a lot of time at the beach. You did not love the beach.
That is true. I didn't like taking my shirt off particularly.
No, you were not into that. And I love the ocean. I didn't mind taking my shirt off, but I enjoyed when surfers did for sure.
Yeah, I remember when we were kids, almost all of your paintings were like the beach.
Yeah.
There would always be ocean waves or seagulls or something like that.
Yeah, the ocean is my happy place for sure. And the Boys and Girls Club. I feel like childhood was the beach and the Boys and Girls Club and church were kind of the three things. And balloons, the balloon store. Maybe the four things that described...
We'll get to the balloon store.
That described childhood.
Yeah. Another thing that I remember about you, that I think most people that have met you know, you're a notoriously picky eater. Or you were when you were a kid.
That's a fair statement. I don't think I'm as picky now. But as a kid, yes, I didn't like almost everything.
Tell me about McDonald's and what it means to you.
I mean, it is, I don't want to say my favorite fast food restaurant, but that might be true. And as a kid, it was the only place I would let Dad take us to for many, many years.
Not let, demand is a better word.
And it was chicken nuggets. I'm a chicken nugget kid through and through. I've never had a hamburger in my life.
You still haven't to this day?
I still have not to this day. So, yeah, chicken nuggets, french fries, and a Diet Coke.
Wow. I remember when we were kids, Dad would take us, and he wouldn't... You were like, the first thing you always wanted to do is play on the play place.
Yeah.
That was like your big thing.
It's the only reason I wanted to go there, really.
Yeah, and the toys and the Happy Meal, I think.
For sure.
Because when we were kids, they were pretty awesome.
Yeah, and what other kid went 7 days a week? Like, when they had the Beanie Babies, I had all of the Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
And then I would sell them at school. I had a whole racket going on.
I remember we had the Batman cups. We had the Lion King soundtrack that you could get at McDonald's.
I don't remember any of that. I remember the Beanie Babies pretty exclusively.
Well, that's because you were a businessman even then.
This is true.
So you used to, Dad, we would sit outside and you would purposefully sit across from me so that you could hand me your food under the table so that you could go play quicker. Like, you just give me your, like, it was like the Underground Railroad, so you could just, like, feed me the nuggets.
Dad,
so you could be free.
Dad would not allow me to play until I ate all my chicken nuggets.
Yeah.
And I was tiny, and I didn't want six. Six chicken nuggets. I just wanted to play in the playpen.
Yeah.
It was, like, the only place I could be free, and I had my friends, and I was, like, the king of the castle in the rainbow ball pen.
Yeah. Those were the days. Fun story. Tell the people about the glass door incident.
Wait, was that you or me?
That was you.
I thought it was you in my mind.
No, it was definitely you.
I was obsessed with Power Rangers.
That's right.
Like, really obsessed with Power Rangers. And I wanted to be a Power Ranger. And this is, like, peak Power Ranger time. And we were regulars at the McDonald's of San Clemente. And I'll never forget, I thought, you know, the indoor restaurant opened two glass doors that opened into the outdoor playpen. And I thought I could high kick the door open when I was, I don't know, 12,
you were little.
13,
yeah.
11.
Maybe younger.
I'm short now, but I was definitely shorter and younger and thinner and not strong. And in my head, I could do this like sideways karate kick, like a Power Ranger, and push my leg up and kick the door open and then walk out there like I own the place. Mm-hmm. But instead, I shattered the entire glass door.
You did. I remember being with Dad at the counter and we're ordering food.
Yeah.
And then you kind of just like came over to us like kind of frantically but quietly, like, we need to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Right now.
It's time to go.
Yeah. And then Dad was like, what the fuck? Why do we gotta go? And then
because he had just ordered. And so then he was pissed.
You showed him and he didn't want to pay for it, so we just booked it.
We left.
Yeah. That was like
classic. I'm sure they figured it out. I mean, they didn't have video cameras, but we've probably given them 100,000 glass doors over in the years that we ate dinner at McDonald's.
Our dad was on the first name basis with like everyone that worked there.
Yeah, I think it's because he also spoke Spanish, so they were all friends. They were mostly of Mexican descent, and we don't speak Spanish really.
I mean, I do, but you don't really.
And he, I mean, I can get by.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was best friends with anyone that he could talk to, I think, so.
Yeah. Tell me also, let's talk about liquor stores. Liquor stores growing up. Me and you were notorious liquor store kids. I feel like everywhere we lived, there was so many liquor stores in
Within walking distance. And I guess I didn't realize it wasn't a normal thing to have liquor stores everywhere. And I also didn't realize till I was older that kids probably like shouldn't go in liquor stores.
Yeah.
But I guess we call it a liquor store, but they're also like kind of a corner store. I mean, they had some snack foods, which is why we went. We obviously didn't go to buy liquor.
Yeah.
We were children.
We went for like candy and soda.
And they just happened to have like 95% liquor and 5% not liquor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We were poor. I had a sweet tooth. And I also had really scrunchy pants that you thought would be a great vehicle to lift some candy bars out of a store.
Yep.
Remember those pants? They were like...
They were like jazz pants.
Yeah, not really, but like... What's that movie, that basketball movie?
Space Jam?
Yeah, they're like Space Jam pants. That's what I think about. Like athletic 80s fashion.
Yeah.
And they were scrunchy at the bottom and scrunchy at the top, and you would literally take me with you.
Of course.
Pull the side of my pants open, fill it with candy, and then we would walk out like we didn't just steal candy.
Yeah, because you were like 3 feet tall, so they didn't even, when you were walking out, they didn't even see the top of your head walk out the door. They just heard the ding dong.
And I'm walking as if I just like rode a horse for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Trying to pretend like there's not candy in my pants. Reese's, Snickers, everything.
Yeah. The other thing, the last thing I remember from our childhood is that people don't know this. Me and you took dance lessons. There was a dance studio across from our house.
Kids. I used to sit on the roof because I wanted to take ballet.
Yep.
But they wouldn't let me take ballet.
Me and you took one class each, I remember, because we used to go there and bug the guy that owned the studio all the time. Because
it was directly across the street.
Literally across the street.
Yeah.
So we both went. You went and took one ballet class. And I went and took a class called Street Funk.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So we each took a different class. And I remember we met up afterwards and you were like, oh, that was cool. But then you like weren't really into it after that. You wanted to just like go play.
Well, I was mad because they wouldn't. I learned the truth of genderized dance and men point and lift and women twirl and wear cute outfits.
They do the fun shit.
Yeah, they do all the fun stuff. And I wanted to do the fun stuff. And they were like, no, you point and you lift. And I vividly remember them telling me, you're built more for gymnastics. Because I wasn't tall.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I wasn't tall, basically. And a ballerina, typically, or ballet dancer, male ballet dancers, taller than the female. And so they basically like ruined the dream for me. I saw myself in a tutu, having the solo moment, being lifted, and they were like, no, no, no.
They're boys, like, that's not for you.
That's not how this works. Boys don't get lifted, boys lift. And I was like, I can't lift anything.
Yeah, little Joe.
So then they said I should try gymnastics, and I did not like that response, so I never went back.
Well, do you know what happened to me on that day of Street Funk?
No, I don't know.
So we go inside, and there's like a pretty mixed group. And I'd never been in a dance studio, obviously.
Yeah.
And it was like, there's like the one big mirror wall, you know?
Yeah.
With like the pole and you like stretch and stuff. So we go in there and we're like warming up and I'm all excited. I'm wearing like basketball shorts and a shirt. And
classic.
I'm, yeah. I mean, pretty much.
Still Orange what you're County wearing kid. Right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, why change perfection? So we're in there, right? And we're like doing warm-ups, like dance moves and stuff. And at a certain point, like the teacher's like, okay, now we're going to do some stretches. And there's the real reason I took that class is because there was like two girls that
I was
going to
ask you
really
who was
cute.
In that class.
Yeah. There was like two really cute girls, right? And so we're like, they're like, okay, we're going to like do these stretches now. So we did the one where you sit down and you like you put your legs, your feet together and your knees facing out. You know that one where you like push down on your knees, kind of like a butterfly. And then I felt kind of weird when I was doing it. I was like, this feels weird. And then we did the one where you put one leg out and then grab it and then the other foot out and grab it.
Yeah.
And then we went back to the butterfly. And when we were doing the butterfly the second time, I heard giggling. And I was like, what the fuck? And I looked at the mirror and you could see all my goodies.
Your butt was straight up out.
I was not wearing underwear. So my junk was just on full display.
Everything.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The whole thing.
Pre-puberty? Like this is like.
It must have been.
Wow.
And I was like just mortified. I just got up and booked it.
So you never went back because you were embarrassed.
Yeah, exactly.
I never went back because they wouldn't let me be the star.
They wouldn't fulfill your dreams.
Correct.
Yeah, so that was the end of our dance years.
I did dance at the Boys and Girls Club.
Did you?
We had a little dance group, yeah. And the first song we did was Space Jam.
Oh my God, of course.
Or the song was in Space Jam.
I Believe I
and
Can Fly?
No. It was High Energy. Oh. It was not I Believe I Can Fly. It was dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And it
was like
these
jock jams.
It was jock jams, and it was all eight counts to the left and then to the right.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
Yeah. So the other thing about our childhood before we move on is you would get picked on a lot because a lot of boys would call you like, I don't want to say it. It's a three-letter word that means an effeminate man.
Yeah.
That would happen to you a lot when we were kids.
I mean, you can say it.
Well,
it's not like I haven't heard it.
I know. But you would get called that word by like so many people because you were like an effeminate kid a little bit.
Yeah.
Like you played with Barbies. You were very like
when I could
bouncy. Yeah,
when
I mean,
was allowed
yeah.
to.
You'd find whatever girl lived on our street that would like let
yeah.
you and you'd play with the.
I liked crafting. I had all girlfriends.
Yeah.
I was who I was and I wasn't like all the other boys. And so I was for sure. Yeah, people picked on me in that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't really understand it. You know what I mean? Like I was just doing me and I was like, what's wrong with you? Like.
Yeah.
You don't like the same things I like? That's weird. And people would always be like, when's your voice? When are you going to go through puberty? And I'm like, I think I did. Even now, like I'm 35 and people still call me ma'am or she on the phone.
You do a little bit sound like a raspy lesbian a little bit. Kind of got that's your vibe a little bit.
Raspy lesbian. You know, the reality is like I can't change my voice.
Yeah.
It doesn't really go any lower. And I guess I'll be Miss Meyer for the foreseeable future. Every time I call the bank, every time I call anyone on the phone
yeah.
that doesn't know me.
Oh my
it's
God.
Always Miss Meyer, Madam Meyer, ma'am. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Okay.
So, yeah. So as we grew up, you started taking like a lot of responsibility, earlier than I did. Like you were the first one of us to get a job. I didn't have any kind of job until like I was older at the Boys and Girls Club. I did the scoreboard. But when you were really young, you started working at a balloon
Sunshine
store.
Cafe first.
Oh, Sunshine Cafe first. Tell us about that.
I was the busser. Basically, I wanted things. And Dad, we were poor, number one. Number two, Dad said, if you want anything, get a job and buy it. And I was like, okay. So I was a busser at the Sunshine Cafe.
How old were you?
I think I was 12 or 13.
Wow. How's that not illegal?
It probably was, but our parents weren't around and
yeah.
I wanted the money and they would give me the job. And then from there, right next door to the Sunshine Cafe was the pet store.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would go from the cafe from busing to bagging goldfish. And they wouldn't let me bag any other fish because they were too expensive. And I was young and I guess eager and sometimes overinflated the bags
uh-huh.
that the fish would go in. And then from there was San Clemente Balloons.
Ah, that's the one I remember is you working for this random older lady.
Tina.
Yeah. And that you just somehow had like took over.
Yeah, she basically she taught me everything she knew, which in the balloon world isn't a lot, if I'm being honest. You know, we did arches, not animals. People always ask if I can make a balloon animal, and I cannot.
Well, you're not a clown.
No, but you say balloons, and that's like where people's mind goes.
Yeah.
We did arches for like the AIDS run, the breast cancer walk, any grand opening. We did Walmart, Disneyland, all these big things. Anything with balloons, we did it. And she basically paid me, I think it was like $7 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to drive in the company van. I got my license in the San Clemente Balloons minivan wrapped in balloons.
Wow.
Yeah, it was wildly embarrassing.
Uh-huh.
But
like that's what you took to the test?
Yeah, because we didn't have a car Dad wouldn't let me use his car. And yeah. Now that I look back, of course she wanted me to drive because then I could do the ordering, drive myself, set up the balloons, drive myself back, and then give her the check. Like, I ran her whole company.
You did everything.
I did everything. And then we ended up going from retail to wholesale. So we bought the wholesaler that we were buying from, and I was running her wholesale business, her retail business, and her events business.
Wow.
And I was like 15.
Yeah.
And when I was 18, she offered to sell me the business.
The whole business.
The whole business. I think it was like $30,000. And I didn't do it because the good church boy in me knew I had to be a missionary or do missionary work.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, she offered to sell me the business because I was doing it all myself anyways. And I think she was ready to retire.
Yeah. So, I mean, for $30,000, don't you feel like you could have just started your own balloon and flower business?
Totally.
Or did she have infrastructure?
She had infrastructure and she had name recognition and she kind of was the one that had all the accounts. And so to kind of slide into that, not even slide in, I was already doing it all,
mm-hmm.
Would sort of have been easy. I mean, I didn't have $30,000. I don't think Dad had $30,000. But it wasn't even an option. In my mind, it was a one-track mind. I was going to do missionary work for the church, and that everything that I really wanted didn't matter. You know, mm-hmm. I had a full ride to school. I gave that up. I had won the Youth of the Year in the city and the state.
For the
Boys and Girls Club. And I gave up the national title, which would have been a scholarship and a 1-year speaking engagement around the country. Because in my mind, there was nothing more important than doing missionary work for the church.
Yeah. So basically, as kids growing up, we kind of had a double life. We had our home life, our San Clemente life, which was school friends, and then we had our church life because our dad joined the Unification Church when we were pretty little.
Yeah,
I was in seventh grade, and I think you were in fifth or sixth grade.
Yeah, I was young.
I tell this famous story of the first time we ever went to church. Do you remember that day?
Was it in San Diego or LA?
It was in San Diego.
I don't remember.
So here's the famous Jove Meyer and Eris Meyer first day of church. God. So up until that point, you and me had never, I mean, I had never been to church before.
Yeah, it wasn't what we had done.
We didn't grow up religious.
No.
We didn't, that just wasn't a part of our life. We watched cartoons. We made crass jokes.
I went to the Boys and Girls Club.
We went to the Boys and Girls Club. We played on the street. That was our life. We weren't religious at all.
Yeah.
So I remember that morning, Dad bribed us and was like, hey, I want to go to church. And me and you were like, get the fuck out of here. We don't go to church.
Yeah, that's not what we do.
It was like a Sunday morning, yeah. And he was like, well, I'll buy you. I think he offered to buy me a video game and you something. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm sure we bartered.
So we were like, yeah, okay, whatever. Whatever church is, yeah, let's do it. So we go, and we go to San Diego, and we pull up, and it's like a house. And I remember me and you just being like, okay.
A beautiful house, but it's a house.
Yeah. We were just like, I guess this is church. Okay. So we go in, and it was just like predominantly Asian people, smells that we didn't really know what they were.
Yeah.
And it was just like, things were happening. They were singing songs, talking, and me and you were just like so aloof. But the moment that I remember is there was a time when they were like, okay, it's time for all the kids to go to, like, you know, youth service.
Sunday school.
So me and you go there and we go outside. And I remember it was Halloween. It was October because the conversation was about Halloween. And these kids, you know, grew up in this church. They're all very, like, you know, pious pure. And sweet and pure and innocent.
Innocent.
And me and you, these little, you know, wild street kids are just, like, sitting there with them. And they're going in a circle and they're saying, oh, what do you want to be for Halloween? Oh, what do you want to be for Halloween? And then they get to this girl and her name is Lorena. And they're like, what do you want to be for Halloween? And she says whatever it was. I don't remember. But you were like, you know who you should be? You should be Lorena Bobbitt. And I was like, yeah. And then you could throw fake dicks at people. And me and you start laughing. And the girl that was running the Sunday school, her face was just turned pale white. And she was just like, yeah. That was like my big memory of our first time at church. Like,
I don't remember that at all, but I 100% believe it to be true.
It was true, yeah. I
had
never
a mouth
forget it.
And I was witty, and if I thought it, I said it.
Yeah.
And her name was Lorraine. Like, how do you...
Lorena, yeah.
How do you not talk about that? Yeah. You know what I mean? How do you not bring that up?
I mean, I know that the person in charge knew what we were talking about. I don't know if the other kids did.
Sure, probably
but
not.
She got it.
For sure not.
Yeah. But after that, we went to church in LA, and that's when we made most of our friends.
The Fish Factory.
And then we went to summer camp, and that's, I think, where we really became church members, was after summer camp.
Yeah.
What were some of your initial feelings at that summer camp? Like, what was it about that summer camp that made you want to continue going to the church?
I think for me, the positives of the church were community and ritual. The amount of friends that we made, both you and I, and it was a sense of family and belonging that I don't think we had otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't about doctrine when I was a kid. You know, I didn't really understand, didn't really matter to me. But these were people I could relate to, I wanted to be with. They were super nice, and we always had a good time. I mean, the arts and crafts was my favorite with Aunt Robin. We did a lot of crafting,
mm-hmm.
Being out in nature. I mean, without the church and the Boys and Girls Club, I don't know what we would have had structure-wise.
None.
As children, right? Like, we would have been running around on the streets, eating Jack in a Box, hanging out alone or separate or together. Like, I don't really know. So, yeah, I have a lot of fond memories of camp in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And singing songs. I thought I was, like, a really good singer. I'm not. I'm totally tone deaf, but...
That hasn't changed. You still sing at the top of your lungs.
You know, like, pretending you got the harmony when clearly you don't have the harmony.
Yeah.
And for me, I think also I always wanted to be... There was something in me that always had to be at the top, the best of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it was Boys and Girls Club, Keystone Club, I needed to be the president, or... If we're going to go to camp, then I need to become a count. Like, I always wanted to be a leader in mm-hmm. the top position of whatever I could achieve. And so having those things to look forward to was nice.
Yeah. The way that I rationalize that, because I think in the church, you and I both at a certain point kind of decided we were going to be, like, loud, proud, and in front of everybody. We were going to lead songs. We were going to be the most vocal, the most pious. And... growing up, we didn't really have a mother. She left when we were very young. So it was just us and our dad. And I think that when we joined the church, it was like we were getting so much like kind of love and attention that we had never really gotten before.
Yeah.
Kind of and feeling these new feelings of friendship and
family.
And family, yeah. So I feel like we overcompensated because we wanted that love so much, and we were just like, I could only speak for myself, but tell me if this rings true. I'm going to be as loud and proud as I can to get this love, you know?
I think it was subconscious, but I think that's absolutely correct. And then I think the other thing is there was a weird hierarchy in the church, and we were not second gen. We were Jacob's children.
Yeah.
So basically we were second class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we had followed all of the rules and guidelines. And so I think for you as well as for me, wanting to be included and in this family and do the best we could was part of that. But also for me, it was like trying to make up for something that we had no control over, but that felt like a deficit.
Yeah. And what you're referring to by that is basically in the Unification Church, the ground theology that Reverend Moon says is basically Adam and Eve were supposed to have God's family on earth, but Lucifer tempted Eve, who tempted Adam, and because Lucifer tempted Eve, the physical blood lineage of God was taken away, and everyone on earth became Lucifer's lineage.
Fallen.
So Reverend Moon's big thing was Jesus was supposed to have a family to reestablish God's lineage on earth. He failed, and then he appeared to Reverend Moon and told him, hey, you need to have a family on earth, and by doing that, I can have my lineage back on earth.
Yeah.
So all the people that joined the church early...
The
original members, they were married by him.
Their first generation.
Through a ceremony, they had kids, and those kids were supposed to be God's children.
Second generation.
You and I, who were not born into the church, were technically Satan's lineage.
Yeah.
So even though we joined young and kind of grew up with those people...
And the values and followed every single rule...
We were technically in the bottom of the caste system in the Unification Church.
1.5ers.
Yeah, which means... We cannot marry anyone in the church because that would ruin their lineage.
We couldn't marry any second generation.
Yeah, we could marry like first generation. We could
marry first generation. Ourselves are below, but nothing above.
And there was really, they didn't really exist out in Correct. America or in our circles.
Correct.
So anyway, without diving too far into the church, that was a kind of a strange way that we lived where we had our church world where we were doing our best to be a part of it, but we weren't really
fully a part of it.
And then we got our home life where we had one parent. Our mom wasn't there, so we didn't really fully have like a family life.
Well, and then I had a third life, which was me figuring out that I was gay mm-hmm. and what that meant in religious, conservative Orange County in a church that said terrible things about gay people. And when the media said gay people molest children and die of AIDS. So that's all I knew about being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't any of those things. But that was me trying to figure that out. So that was my third world, trying to discover what that means in the context of my church, of my family, and of my town, and also like of myself.
Yeah.
Because there was no dating before marriage. You couldn't even hold the hand of someone of the opposite sex.
Yeah.
And we had arranged marriages. So... In my mind, it was like, I can't be gay because that's bad and I'm good and I want to get married in the church to make my parents happy. So that's it. But that was easy when I was young. But as I got older, the conflict was like
when you were of marriage age and it was really on the horizon that it could actually happen.
Yeah, even before then. I mean, I had no one to talk to about it. You know, like I remember going on AOL chats, which I know you know because you covered for me, which I found out years later that our stepmom, who our dad married in the church, literally asked you about what AOL chats were.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally said like man for man chat. So I would go in the garage late at night, dial up internet. And I would go on chat rooms. I was young. Like, it probably is not safe for a 14-year-old boy to be in a chat room.
Oh, absolutely not.
You know, pretending to be older. Of course, I lied. I said I was older. But I had no outlet to explore how I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone at that age or in that age frame is learning about their body, about their attraction, the difference between a friend and a lover.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the church stunted all of that for everyone.
Totally.
But if you were gay, it was literally not stunted. It was just not even
It
wasn't a thing.
The church was teaching us puritanical, very religious ideas about how you should carry yourself, what sex means, what marriage means.
Yeah.
And we didn't do even sex ed for heterosexual people. Never mind any kind of explanation for anybody else besides... you're going to go to hell unless you fix this.
I remember I was so excited the day they were teaching sex ed at school. And I like ran in and I was like, I'm so excited. And they were like, your dad didn't sign it. I don't know why you're excited. Like, you're not going to sex ed.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you mean? Like, we're all going to sex ed.
Hold up, it's showtime.
Yeah, like, I was ready for them to put that condom on the banana. Yeah. But yeah, we weren't, it wasn't a thing we were supposed to do.
Yeah. I actually remember, so I remember that time when I got in trouble, because she, I would always go on AIM too. So through the church, me and you had both made so many friends.
Yeah.
And the only connections we had with them, because they lived in Los Angeles or San Diego, was to be on AIM, was to send emails.
Yeah.
So I was also always in the computer on AIM.
Yeah.
So I think that I was on there more often than you. So I think she just assumed it would be me.
In the mail for mail chat?
Well, no. Just online.
Oh, got it.
Because she had basically, found an email or, you know, in her mind, she didn't really know exactly what it was, that it was a chat log. But she was just like, are you looking at, like, naked men on the internet? And she was accusing me, like, yelling at me.
I see.
And I was like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah, that's not you.
Why would I look at, I got that. I'm not interested in that. I could look at that all day. I'm looking at I want the other stuff.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know that you had looked at it.
Yeah.
But by process of elimination in my mind, I was like, well, it ain't you me. Or me.
Yeah.
And it could be our dad, I guess.
Sure.
It could be her. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I knew that it wasn't me. And I knew that my guess was it was obviously you.
Yeah.
And since you were a kid, you would get bullied all the time. You would get called that word we talked about earlier by all kinds of dudes. And I can't even count how many people I beat up for calling you that.
Mm.
So it's not like I didn't know that you were an effeminate kid. Obviously, sure. You know, there was girls I had crushes on when we were little and I would find you with them playing Barbies and stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a, you know.
I mean, I wore mom's high heels and lingerie as a dress. Like that was fun for me.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing was though, we were in the church and whenever anyone had asked you that or called you that or accused you of that, it was adamant denial.
For sure.
So I was always like, well, if he says he ain't, he ain't.
Yeah.
And if you want to say he is, I'm going to beat the shit out of you, basically. Yeah. You know, because I was your older brother. Yeah. Like, yeah, no matter what. And also,
you always had my back.
Yeah. Those were weird days. And I know that it's strange because in retrospect, I didn't really know what you were going through.
Yeah.
Even though we literally lived in a one-bedroom apartment our entire lives and slept on two couches in a living room our entire lives.
We were always very close physically.
Yeah, like literally like...
In the same room.
In the same room. But I didn't know that part of your struggle. We were both going through our own struggles.
Yeah.
As far as the church is concerned. But anyway, so I graduate high school and then I left and went on my mission program.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I came home and I started working my job. And you graduated high school.
Yeah.
And you went on your mission trip.
Yep.
And that's when I think things started getting interesting because me and you had kind of like worked our way pretty high up in the church as far as like the way that adults saw us and treated us to the point where you and I were giving like, we were doing like almost like a speaking engagement at one point.
Yeah.
Where we were going around in different areas of the country, church and like, giving lectures and you know, inspiring the members and we were doing that kind of stuff. And at that point you had gone to community college in the Bay Area after you graduated, you stayed, right?
Well, I did, or not after you one, finished not your two, service but program. 3 years of missionary work.
That's
two
right.
Was standard. Again, with my overachieving issues, I went for 3.
Yeah.
And then I stayed in the Bay Area and did 2 years of school before moving to New York.
And that was at Chabot Community College?
Yeah, Chabot Community College, which is where all the other church members in the Bay Area kind of went. There was a house I lived in with roommates that all were from church, from the missionary program.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really conflicting because I remember I came out my second year of missionary.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like when you think of coming out today, it's a very, you know, kind of interesting feeling. And it's sort of like sighing out this relief and like
supposed
looking
to be liberating.
For acceptance and liberating and living your true life. But, in the church, the only thing we knew was that gay people were worse than dog shit.
Mm-hmm. That was like a direct quote from the founder.
Yep.
He called gay people dung-eating dogs, I think was the exact.
And that never, ever left my brain. And that I would die of AIDS. And mm-hmm. so for me, it was really difficult because the church told me one thing and my heart and body felt another thing. Mm-hmm. And it was really around the world of, do I get married, have a wife, have a family, and keep my family, my church family and my real family, you, dad, everyone that we loved, or do I explore this terrible thing within me, possibly molest children, definitely get AIDS and die alone with no family and no church?
Yeah.
Like for me, it was very black and white. There was no gray area. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I wasn't going to explore the gay side because it would mean my family, my church community, everything I ever knew would go away in my head.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was a church holiday, God's Day, which is New Year's Eve, and you don't celebrate, you repent and you start over. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was the biggest sin that I had been keeping or hiding or living with. And I'll never forget that I confessed the sin to the reverend and ultimately cried my eyes out because I had never said it out loud.
And the only person you had ever told is this church person?
First and only that I had ever told. Because no one in high school, I was in theater, I was in musical theater, I was in mm-hmm. dance.
Oh, cover, yeah.
All those boys.
No one suspected.
For sure, I had crushes on all of them, and we'd be in the dressing room and like reach across from one another, uh-huh. and it was like the most erotic thing in the world. Uh-huh. And we were fully clothed in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And all of them now are out and gay and married and happy, but at the time, no one was gay. No one was gay on TV, no one was gay in radio, no one was gay at our high school, like... I didn't know anyone.
That you knew. There were obviously famous people.
That I knew.
You had no role models in that world.
No, I had nothing to aspire to say, I can be gay and live a full life.
Yeah.
All I thought was I could be gay and die of AIDS. Mm-hmm. And maybe molest children, which...
Which is what you were always told that gay people do.
That was it. So I didn't relate to that. And so when I confessed my sins, literally that... church leader said, thank you for sharing. We need to get you married as soon as possible.
Yikes.
And I was a missionary leader leading other men, which I never, ever crossed the line with any church member, ever. Mm-hmm. And the moment, literally like the next day, I was moved to another position in a house with mixed company, not in a van. And it all just kind of shifted. Mm-hmm. And everything was different for me. And I felt the shift, and I didn't like the shift, and I think it sort of was the beginning of me really starting to kind of question everything.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, you were going to school and working, right, at like Mimi's Cafe, kind of yep. what kind of waitery jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I had to pay all my own bills. You worked for the church for 3 years, and you got... smiles in heaven. You didn't get anything for it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I waited tables at Mimi's Cafe. I was in theater in college, and then I was living with fellow church people. And I was on the internet, like on Craigslist and Googling, like, what does it mean to be gay? And everyone in theater was like, oh my God, do you have a boyfriend? They just assumed.
Yeah. I mean, it was...
I was gay.
Yeah.
And I would fight it tooth and nail, deny it every chance I got. Because to me, again, that meant a really terrible life.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until that second year of college, I auditioned for the movie Milk. Mm-hmm. And I grew out mutton chops and a mullet. It was really the popular kid in town.
It was like the least gay haircut you could get.
Yeah, it was not good. I also had no style at all back then.
I remember.
Taste level.
T-shirts, puka shells,
ooh, so
denim.
So many puka shells.
Yeah.
And really bad glasses and the bowl cut that never went away.
Classic bowl cut.
Yeah. So I auditioned for this movie. I didn't know what it was about, but
you
I got an audition and
that's
I was like
the gayest story ever. You really didn't know what Milk was about?
No, because wow. Who would have taught me?
That's true, I guess.
Who would have told me? Mm-hmm. So I just auditioned because there was a leading role that I could have got. And I was like, yeah, I want to be in a movie with Sean Penn. That sounds like a great first, you know, acting gig. And I auditioned for a number of weeks. I didn't get the role, but they said, how would you feel about being a featured extra? You can learn all these things. And I was like, sure, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. And basically, we filmed in San Francisco every day for 3 months. And it was the first time in my life I had met openly gay people that were happy, that were joyful, that were normal, that were in love, that had families. I mean, every walk of life, every look, every age, every race, every ability, every size, and they were all gay men. Mm-hmm. And I just was blown away that everything I had thought or been told was wrong. And these people were all so lovely and happy. And I was like, I can be happy and me? Like, it was just a novelty that I had never thought about. And then I had a breakthrough moment with the writer of the movie, Dustin Lance Black, who basically, again, overachieving Jove, I would see the stand-in and I would always position myself behind the stand-in. Mm-hmm. So I was in too many shots of the movie. And the director pulled me aside and said, if you don't stop, I'm going to have to write you into this movie. Yeah. And I was like, great. That sounds perfect. So they basically paid me my full salary to sit in a room alone to not go on set.
Oh my God.
Because I was in so much tape that like,
yeah,
they had to get me off scenes.
Totally. I remember as a kid, you used to do that when reporters would come to the Boys and Girls Club. Yes. You would follow around the reporters and try to get in every picture.
Yeah.
And you were in so many newspaper covers.
Yeah, it works, right? So, like, yeah. Why not try it? I've always been a hustler, for sure.
You've always been tenacious.
So, anyways, I would sit in the room and I'd be bored out of my mind. There's no Facebook. There's no, like, internet on your phone. It's just me in a room. Mm-hmm. Everyone's on set having fun. I'm alone. So then I would go to the coffee bar, the snack station, and the only other person not working was the writer. Mm-hmm. And so we finally started talking because I was like, why are you here? And he's like, why are you here?
Yeah.
And it turns out he's the writer. It turns out he was raised Mormon. And so it was a very similar upbringing, very strict religious beliefs around male, female, around heteronormative culture, around abstinence before marriage. Marriage is the most important thing in your life and your family is your happiness. Mm-hmm. And he shared his story with me. And it really changed my perspective, my heart. Like, what do you mean? Like, you told your parents you didn't marry in the Mormon church and you're happy and you're successful and you don't have AIDS. Like, it sounds so simple saying it now and almost rude, but that was where my mind was at.
Well, I mean, I think people don't understand when you grow up in the kind of environment that we did that was so hyper religious and like insulated.
And all inclusive. Yeah. Your summers, your winters, your Sundays. Like we were in it, fully in it.
Yeah. Fully immersed. And it's funny because there was at one point I remember that my dad wanted to get you in a relationship with this girl. He wanted you to marry this girl.
There were several.
Yeah. And in the church, it's called matching, where basically both sets of parents choose a person for their kid. And I remember that he had left you at their house one night by surprise and wanted you to like get to know her.
There was so much shady, sneaky shit around that. It was not black and white. And I kept hiding behind STF, the missionary, the church missionary work. I was like, I need to focus on my missionary work maybe next year. And I did it for 3 years. And then they'd be like, what about this girl? I'm like, she's too skinny. Yeah. She's too Asian. She's too tall. She's too black. She's too short. She's
anything
too young.
You could think of.
Anything I could think of because I couldn't do it.
I remember that so he left you at that girl's house. And then her family's from LA. And then I would see them at church and my dad would always talk to her dad. And I remember at a certain point, I could feel kind of where you were at. You had never said out loud to me that you're gay. You had never brought that up.
Well, and when I came out, I didn't say I'm gay.
No, you didn't.
In the church. Yeah. I suffered from same-sex attraction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not I'm gay. I suffered from same-sex attraction. I'm a sinner who needs to repent.
But I remember that I told her dad at one point, these two shouldn't be together. This is not going to work. You should not do this. And I remember that I became public enemy number one.
Yeah.
He was so angry. Dad was angry. They were like, why aren't you letting these two kids be together?
Yeah.
And I just kind of knew, like, this protective older brother part of me was like, I know this is going to be a train wreck.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
This is not going to work. Let's not do this. So he was like, even still, he gives me the eye sometimes.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was all going on. You were in college. You did the movie. And then what happened after that? You decided to go to a different school.
So there was kind of like a decision that had to be made. I applied to 5 colleges, half for acting, half for pre-law and political science. And I got in everywhere, which I did not expect. And ultimately, the best option was to go to UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. I had a full ride. I had their merit scholarship. They were going to pay me to go to school, room and board. I had a car. I had just been offered a brand new job that I would have made bank. It would have been a win-win situation, except the church is based there. The house I was going to live in was a church house. And I would have continued to live this lie that really wasn't working.
Yeah. You were in a community there. There was no escaping or exploring. Yeah, I was
like teaching Sunday school. It's not like I could explore my life the way authentically I needed to figure out who I was. I had to continue to live the lie that made everyone else happy and comfortable, but that was killing me inside. Mm-hmm. And so I literally sold my car, quit my job, packed up one suitcase, and moved to New York City. I didn't know anybody. And went into debt, great debt. I did not get a full ride to that college.
To Columbia.
To Columbia. And luckily, you had friends in New York, and I was their roommate. I mean, I lived in their apartment, in their extra bedroom. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2008. Yeah. I kind of decided, if I stay in California, I'm going to get married to a woman in the church. We're going to have children. It's going to be great to start, but my life is not going to be joyful, real, authentic, happy, and neither is hers. But there was a point for a matter of a month where I was really, really considering it. And there was someone I was talking to.
Really?
That our parents didn't really know about. And in my mind, it was just like, it's like so strong, the desire to belong and to be a part of something and to have approval from your family and your community. And I just wanted to be normal.
I think that me and you both have that in spades because we grew up without a mom.
Yeah.
We both have this never ending need to feel accepted and loved. And basically to like, we overcompensate because we feel unworthy of love. So we're always like, We got to do more. And I know that for me, that manifested in a very different way than you. I went in, I wrote poems and listened to music, and you went out, you worked, you hustled, you created. So you're in New York, and then you're just trying to make ends meet, working like waiter jobs.
Again, working full-time through school. Mm-hmm. I was a server at Bubba Gump in Times Square.
Yeah.
The only place that would hire me because I didn't have New York experience because I just moved there. But it's a real thing in restaurants in New York. If you don't have New York experience, nobody will hire you. Uh-huh. But also growing up in the church, we never drank alcohol, so I didn't know anything about alcohol.
Yeah.
And I actually bagged a really good restaurant interview. I was on the third interview with a sommelier. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what wine was, but I like charmed my way into this interview and literally sat down with the somm, and they were like, let's talk about wine. And I was like, absolutely. And they were like, name grape varietals. And I was like, red, white, pink. Like I was like box or bottle. Like I had no reference point. Like we had no culture, no exposure.
Nope.
And they literally walked me out of the restaurant. I walked into Times Square. My rent was due in 30 days. I had no money. I like took everything. It was like the big risk. And I walked through Times Square like, okay, I have no more interviews, but I'm going to figure this out. And I walked down Times Square, and there's Bubba Gump, and they're outside saying like, we're hiring. And so the door was wide open, and I was like, well, if this isn't a sign, you know, and I went in and interviewed 3 interviews in an hour, and I was hired on the spot, and I slang fried shrimp in the middle of Times Square for longer than I have cared to.
Bubba Gump, the real New York experience.
Yes, real classy.
Okay, so tell me about school. What were you going to school for?
So initially my thought, my love was for theater, but we grew up very poor. Mm-hmm. And I think theater is something you pursue if you're wealthy or well off.
We both did theater in high school.
Yeah, we both loved it. Yeah. But it's, in my mind, I'm such a practical person. And I wanted more than anything not to grow up poor, not to live a life that we came from.
The opposite of what we had.
Yeah. And so I knew that if I were to pursue theater, A, I'd be really in debt with no guaranteed employment. And that regardless of my hard work or talent, I could never be guaranteed to achieve success. Hmm. You could be really the most talented performer in the world and literally never book a job your whole life.
Yeah.
And I didn't necessarily want fame, but I wanted success. I wanted to be able to pay my bills and live a certain life.
Yeah.
And there was a part of me that just felt like that could never happen. And not due to my efforts or my lack of trying, it just could never happen. And the other part of me was into law. I mean, you know, as a kid, I always threatened to sue everyone who disagreed with me.
Whenever dad would try to like spank you because you were mouthing off for being bad, that was always your line.
Yeah.
I'll sue you.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't hit me. I'll call protective services. I'll sue you.
Yeah. I wanted to sue.
You were a litigious kid.
I was a very litigious child. Yes. And so I thought I would go into law school because I could see the investment of college that I paid for myself. With a career that would land a certain amount of money that I could pay back my college debt and have a living that would be a nice life. But I also felt very responsible to take care of our family.
Yeah.
Because our parents didn't have retirement, didn't have stable jobs. We didn't have a stable childhood financially. We didn't have anything. So I also felt quietly responsible for them. Hmm. And so I felt like, if I'm going to Columbia, I can't go to Columbia for theater.
Yeah.
If I'm going to turn down UCLA, USC, Stanford for theater, I can't go to Columbia for theater. Like, I have to go there and do pre-law and then go to Harvard Law School. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to be the best at it. Like,
yeah.
That has always been my energy, and that was what I was going to do. So it was pre-law, which doesn't really exist as a category, but U.S. politics and economics and sort of these things that you do that combined are pre-law. There isn't a pre-law category.
Yeah.
But in my head, it was Harvard Law School was where I was going to go.
Okay. And then so right now you're known professionally on social media, on TV, and everything you do. Your company is called Jove Meyer Events. You're an event planner, a wedding event planner. How did you go from pre-law in Columbia to event planning?
Yeah, I always loved throwing a party. Since we were kids, I decorated the house for every holiday
with
Trader Joe bags or whatever I could find. The whiteboard, we had a huge whiteboard, which is so weird. But whatever, I would decorate, I would draw on that. I always loved decorating, designing, and partying. And that didn't really change. And then when I was in college, I worked in hospitality, so sort of food and beverage. And ultimately, I dated a lawyer, and this lawyer was the one who, like, crushed my dreams.
Wait. You dated a male lawyer?
Yes, which is, like, a whole other conversation. The first date I ever went on was life-changing for me.
Well, for the listeners, can you tell them when did that... You don't have to tell the story, but when did you... Tell us a little bit about when you came out or when you decided to pursue that part of yourself. You know what I mean?
So the first year I was at Columbia, I told everyone I was straight because I moved to New York to get away from the church and start over. And then the church moved to New York.
Like, well, I think the church was already in New York. Yes, we just didn't know that.
Totally. But then there was a new leader who was based in New York. Mm-hmm. And so like that was the center of the church. And now I was there and everyone knew I was there because we were a tight community. And so for the first year, I outwardly said I was straight. And then I was secretly dating people on the internet and that's a whole other thing. Closet dating is not great, and living a total fake life was not great, but I had a feeling that even if I told my trusted peers in college who were liberal and not in the church, somehow they would tell someone who knew someone in the church, and everyone would find out, and I would be disowned or disavowed or turned away without it being my story or my power.
Yeah.
So I just kept that lid tightly on and then secretly dated on the internet. And ultimately, I reached a turning point in my life where I spent my whole life trying to change mm-hmm. for other people, our parents, the church community, the church leaders.
Yeah.
And I had a moment where I realized I'm not the one who needs to change. They need to change.
Mm-hmm.
The church needs to change. Our parents need to change. Society needs to change, because there's nothing wrong with me. And that was like huge for me, because I had never felt like that. I had always felt like shit, yeah. less than, never good enough, you know, a myriad of feelings that weren't positive. And I had that realization, and I wrote basically an essay to our dad and stepmom that I sent to them on Thanksgiving. And it basically outlined why me being gay doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a wonderful human. I still care about others. I still have good character. I still am who I am. And here's all the theological reasons you still should love me, basically.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was in college, so writing papers was what I knew.
Yeah.
And I felt like if I called them, it wouldn't work. And that was Thanksgiving 2008 or 9. And that was kind of my coming out to the family. Mm-hmm. And it was weird, but I had to sort of take the power of that moment on myself.
Yeah. I remember when you called me.
First.
I was on my lunch break at work, and you called me, and do you remember the way you told me?
No.
It was like, it was almost a riddle. You were like, hey, Harris, I just want to let you know I'm seeing someone. And I was like, oh, cool. And I don't remember the name, so I'm just going to make up a name.
Sure.
I'm seeing someone. I was like, oh, cool. And you're like, and his name is Joe. And I was like, okay. So does that mean... In my head, I'm doing the math.
For sure.
Does that mean you're bi?
Yeah.
Are you gay? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
And you were like, I'm gay. Which is the first time I ever heard you say it.
Out loud, yeah.
And immediately in my mind, it was almost like you said, we're gay. Mm-hmm. As in me and you.
Yeah.
Because we're on the same team. No matter what, we're connected. I'm your older brother. It's us versus everybody. In my mind, obviously. So you said that. I said, okay. And of course, a lot's racing through my head about the church, about our family, about whatever. And me just thinking like, all right, well, here, this is what we're doing now. This is it, you know?
Yeah.
So you told me, and then slowly after that, you know, everyone started finding out, whether it was church people, church adults, our peers, our family.
Well, I changed my status on Facebook.
Really?
Which in 2008, 9 was like Facebook's peak.
A declaration.
Yeah. And so I went on and I changed interested in women to interested in men.
Yeah.
And that was like, because that's really where 95% of the people on Facebook at that time were church people. Like,
yeah.
We went from all the platforms, but at that time, that was the one we were
on. The majority of our friends on there were church people.
And the majority of my friends were church people, except my new friends in college.
Yeah.
And so, that was my public declaration, was changing my status on Facebook.
Yeah.
And the first summer I was in New York, to answer your first question, one of my very best friends from church, whom I did 3 years of missionary work with, Kirsten, she got matched when we were in California.
Mm-hmm.
Her fiance was in Connecticut, so she moved to the East Coast, and then I moved for college, and she asked me to plan her wedding. And I said, absolutely, that would be so much fun. So we went to the Christmas tree store and IKEA. We were poor college students, both waiting tables, both hustling to pay our bills.
Mm-hmm.
But she still wanted a beautiful wedding. And so I ultimately helped her plan her wedding.
Yeah.
And then I did another church friend's wedding that summer, who also had gotten married, Mastaka Kubo. And And then I was like, this is really fun. And I happened to be dating this guy that was a lawyer. And he basically was like, oh, you want to do workers' comp, human rights law? Like, that's so nice if that's what you want to do. Do you know you're going to make $35,000 a year? And I was like, excuse me? Wait, what? I thought lawyers made like six figures. Uh-huh. And he was like, corporate law makes six figures starting out. You will make $35,000 a year. Let me do some math here for you. Yeah. And he laid out my debt from Columbia, my debt from Harvard Law School, which you can't work in law school. So I had to take on even more debt. And he's like, you'll owe over $2,000 a month in loans, whatever your rent is, whatever your living expenses are. You will be negative money every month. Mm-hmm. He's like, workers' comp law, human rights law is what wealthy people do. Because they don't need money.
Yeah, it's more for show than it is for...
Yeah, and I was like, oh, shit. And I didn't want to go to school for three more years. I did not have a great time in school. It wasn't for me. And I love doing events. And so I literally built a website. I made a logo out of pictures from Kirsten's wedding. Mm-hmm. She wrote me a testimonial. I used her images. I used another friend's wedding's images. I advertised on Craigslist. And I just started hustling. Mm-hmm. And I would literally do anyone's wedding for whatever they could pay me. I think the first time I charged someone, it was $400.
Which is, crazy low.
Yeah, I would never do anything today for $400. Yeah. But at that time, it was like, I'm going to do this to build a portfolio, to build a name, to build a brand, to spread my brand around Brooklyn, mm-hmm. particularly, where I was living. And... then I graduated and was like, if I don't stop waiting tables, I could easily become a lifelong server. And no disrespect to anyone who's in the service industry as a career. It's not what I wanted, mm-hmm. but it's easy. You clock in, you clock out, you make cash money. So I took a low-paying job in events because I knew if I didn't pivot, I could get stuck. And I worked at this startup company doing events. I hired someone to make a logo for me and make a real website for me. And I was kind of juggling both jobs at the same time. And because my weddings were not $400 a wedding.
Yeah.
You'd have to do a lot to pay the bills. And ultimately that company went under. And then I was unemployed and doing some weddings, but it wasn't enough. And so then I got a job at Bloomberg as an event manager. And I made... an amazing salary, more money than I had ever made in my life, mm-hmm. triple what I was making at this out of college job. And all the while I was still building my business. And they knew I had a company and they told me I couldn't work with any of my vendors, which was weird because it's the events industry and you'd think you'd want that.
Yeah.
They were very clear I couldn't have meetings or calls when I was at work, which makes sense. So I would work 5 days a week at Bloomberg and then I'd work weekends and nights on my own business. And then after a year of being at Bloomberg, my business was doing pretty well, but a big corporate job with a nice paycheck was really lovely.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to security. Walk away from that.
Yeah. And I didn't walk away by choice. I was let go on my birthday without warning, reason, or notice after being given a raise, a bonus, a personal assistant, and the CEO, Mike Bloomberg, a private project for him.
Wow.
Literally, I came back from lunch on my birthday. There was a meeting on my calendar, which always happens. We had open calendars.
Yeah.
I went into the room. It was a woman I'd never seen before in my life. And she said, I'm so sorry to let you know you're no longer the right fit for this company.
Wow.
Do you have any questions?
Wow.
And I was like, is this a joke? Like, yeah. Is there cameras somewhere? Like, is this, are you pranking me? And she's like, these security officers will escort you out of the building, will messenger your things from your desk. You're not allowed to come back here ever again.
Did you ever find out why?
No. To this day, I still have no idea.
But it happened to be like the best thing that ever happened to you.
Yeah, it was the scariest thing because I was buying my apartment.
Yeah.
And now I'm unemployed. And but it was. In the end of the day, I mean, I'm happier than I've ever been. I'm more creative than I could have ever been there. There was so much red tape, so much bureaucracy. They said they hired me to help make events creative. And then at every turn, they were like, we just think of white linen and Merlot. And I was like, this is why people aren't coming.
Yeah.
Like, you said no one's coming to your events. You want me to revitalize them. I'm doing that. And at every corner, you're turning it down. Mm-hmm. I also, it was so sad. They wanted me to be straight. You had to be homogenous there. Suit, tie, no beard, no tattoos, no personality, like straight laced, even though I wasn't client facing.
Yeah.
And I was an event person.
Like, that's what they wanted out of their event planner.
Yeah. They wanted me to be finance bro.
They wanted you to be vanilla.
In events. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense. It was so bizarre. But I learned a lot about what I didn't want. Mm. And my business from that point, once it was all I had financially, I was all in. You know what I mean? Like I had to be.
Yeah.
And I was in kind of the right place at the right time, living in Brooklyn. And ultimately, Brooklyn became a thing. Brooklyn weddings were not really a big thing. People think of New York City, they think of a wedding at the Plaza, the Pierre, these really fancy, classic places. And that's not my style. That's not my aesthetic. I never felt comfortable in those places.
Yeah. Of course, and me and you never, I mean, no. I couldn't imagine being in a place where I was wearing a suit or like, no. Even watching TV shows where they're like a bunch of rich New York moms and dads at like a school function or something. Yeah. And I'm just like shuddering, so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's not the world we're reality from at all.
Not at all.
In fact, we used to work for free for the Boys and Girls Club at like fundraisers serving spaghetti to rich people.
Yeah.
That's the closest we ever got to rich people.
Yeah. So it was not my reality. And Brooklyn was much more chill, much more my vibe. Mm-hmm. And I started there years ago, just doing anything for everyone. One year I had like 48 weddings. And I just hustled, spread my name, built a brand, and then really kind of started pushing boundaries without knowing it. I was like, so can I ask why we're doing it that way? Like, why don't we try and do it this way?
Yeah.
Or have we ever thought of doing that? Like, why do we always do this? And slowly people started liking what I was doing and wanting me to plan and design a celebration that didn't look like everyone else's.
Yeah.
That wasn't typical, that wasn't fancy or obnoxious or stuck up or pretentious. And I was like, okay, sure, I can do that. And it's kind of evolved, to be perfectly honest, to a place where I feel really fortunate that I have a brand that I think is distinct, and you can look at our work and say, like, that's a Jove Meyer event.
Yeah.
It's not a someone else's event. Like, it's his.
Yeah. Your brand, to me, obviously, first and foremost, you're 100% LGBTQ and everybody inclusive. Yeah. The most important thing to you is that somebody feels loved, appreciated, and acknowledged as a
everything
human being.
Everything I never got.
Exactly.
100%.
It feels like it's almost the perfect culmination of your journey, of growing up, suffering, doing everything you had to do to make everyone else feel good, whether it was our family or our religion. You almost created a place for somebody like yourself. You were like, I don't want anyone to feel like I felt, and I want to create a place where if I was getting married, this is what I would aspire to be married. Yeah. Like, you know,
I want to celebrate you completely for who you are, not who you have to be, not for who you should be, not for who you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, I want your celebration to be a reflection of you and your fiance's style, personality, relationship, like who you are. Mm-hmm. So many of us spend our life trying to please other people, trying to make other people happy. And to an extent, that's normal. That's natural.
Of course.
But when it goes against every fiber of who you are, it's sad and it's tragic. And so, yeah, I have built a career of empowering other people to be who they are.
Yeah.
And my brand is built on different and celebrating differences and bringing a light to diversity and finding joy and love in that, and not just saying we all have to be skinny, white, straight couples to be on the cover of a magazine.
Or heterosexual couples.
Yeah, or heterosexual, cisgendered couples. And even, 4 years ago, the business took a turn, and I realized that I'm in an industry that didn't want me, that didn't recognize me. I mean, until 5 years ago, I couldn't participate in the work I was doing.
Wow.
I couldn't legally get married. And here I am, planning these beautiful weddings for people, getting emotional, And it wasn't something I had access to.
I mean, isn't that literally the story of our entire lives?
Yes.
Like, that's what's crazy about it.
It's literally like, and I was like, what? This is so wrong.
Yeah.
And then same-sex marriage became legal in, of course, you know, state by state and then federally. And ultimately, I realized our industry, although I know the people in it and they're very inclusive and wonderful, the language, the image, the actions, the transactions were all heteronormative from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people realized it or had malice or were intentionally trying to do harm. But I basically became an educator around making your business LGBTQIAP loving.
Mm-hmm.
And I started teaching around the world to other wedding vendors 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Over 10,000 people taught. And it was a whole other part of my life that I felt like was missing, but was so necessary. I love what I do, my work. I love planning. I love design. But my mission is to make this industry one where we all feel welcome and celebrated for who we are.
Yeah.
And that, there's nothing more that I love than getting up on a stage and using my pain, my hurt, my life, and helping change hearts and minds of other people so no one else has to go through what I did, or what we did, what others have gone through.
Yeah.
For something they can't control, right? I am who I am. Gay people didn't choose to be gay. It's not a switch. It's not a lifestyle. It's not a phase. It's not a fad. It's who I am.
Yeah.
But it's not all of me. It's a part of me. And so, yeah, it's been quite a journey, to be honest.
I never understood how so many people's parents, when their kids come out as gay or trans or whatever it is,
yeah,
how so many people's parents choose their religion over their own children.
Yeah.
How they choose their own, you know, the opinions of strangers over their own family.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but I was one of the people that you inspired to change their life. When you came out, I was still in the church.
Mm.
And I was still, you know, the church is something that both hurt and helped me my entire life.
Yeah.
Just like you, you know, I also in the church felt like, you know, like I was in a place where I couldn't be myself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we were second class citizens. We were in a caste system, basically.
Yeah.
And when you came out, there were so many church adults that would see me at church, or they would, you know, be online and they would send me messages and they would just be like, oh, I feel so sorry for you and your parents. Like, I can't believe this. You know, what are you going to do? And you inspired me by coming out to leave the church.
Mm.
You pushed me. That last step, I've wanted to do it for a long time, but I never had a reason to take that last step.
Yeah.
But you coming out, I mean, even you know, that gave me the bravery to do what I needed to do.
Mm.
And I know that, you know, I'm sure that I'm not the only person. I'm sure you, after you came out, there were so many people in the church that messaged you and they were like, look, I've been hiding who I am my whole life. I'm gay, I'm trans, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, you inspired a lot of people because you were very vulnerable publicly. So I think that that's what I like the most about your business, Jove Meyer Events, is that it's really, you've used your life experience to create this place of love and acceptance. You're the only person I know that has a business that has an ally pledge.
Mm.
Tell the people about your ally pledge. What is that?
Yeah, I basically wanted to put into writing all of the ways in which you can support people who are different from you. And I wanted to put into writing that these are not choices. Your race, your size, your ethnicity, the way you were born, where you were born, your gender, your sexuality. I mean, these are not things anyone has control over. You choose to love people or hate people. Mm-hmm. Discrimination is a choice. Hate is a choice. Everything in my ally pledge is not a choice. So if you're going to choose hate, we are not going to work together. We are not going to collaborate. I'm not going to give you my money or my client's money, because there's no room for hate in the industry of love. I mean, in life in general, but in this industry where people are celebrating love, how dare you not want to work with someone because they're black, because they're queer, because they're disabled, because they're a woman, because they're Jewish, because of anything that is beyond their control. And I really was inspired by Black Lives Matter and that movement. And for many months, I listened, I read, I learned, and I thought, what can I do that I'm not already doing that's concrete, that's real, and that I can hold people accountable? Because in my own business for many years, I would only work with people who were allies. Obviously, I'm gay. Mm-hmm. My clients are not all gay, for sure. They're actually majority straight. But they're thoughtful people who support everyone. And they wouldn't want to work with someone who was homophobic, racist, you know, ageist. So I had always thought everyone that I worked with were good people. And they were not people who discriminated. And then I learned that wasn't the case in some relationships the hard way. And so I put my words into a pledge. I did a lot of homework, a lot of learning, a lot of reading, a lot of listening. And I created a pledge that basically says, if you don't stand up for human decency, human rights, human respect, and equality, A, you don't belong in the industry of love, but B, we're not going to work together. Mm-hmm. And so it's a pledge that I made that I hope other vendors and venues share on their own website. And it's one in the industry, kind of the first of its kind. We don't have a code of conduct. We don't have an ethics code. You can't be disbarred from being a wedding planner. You know, mm-hmm. like you can be racist and successful in our industry. Mm-hmm. You can be homophobic and successful in our industry.
You could be president too.
Absolutely. And so I thought, I'm going to stand for love and I'm going to make a pledge for all of us. And I hope that it catches on. And if you want my client's money and you want to work with us, you have to review, read, accept, and sign this pledge.
That's what's
And up. If you can't sign this pledge, we will not work together. And my hope is that anyone who's hesitating to sign it begins a dialogue and we can have a conversation. The two things not in the pledge are religion and politics, because those are both a choice. And I didn't want anything in there that could be argumentative or that people could say they could disagree with.
Yeah.
Because you cannot disagree with someone's race, gender, sexuality, size, ability, disability. Like, you can't.
Yeah.
You cannot. I'm sorry that your whole life you've had privilege in your whiteness, in your straightness, in your masculinity. But now is a new time.
Yeah.
And there's not a world where I'm giving any power, money, time, or energy to people in business who are not in the business of love, with love for all people.
Yeah. That's what's up. If people want to find your business, or they just want to contact you, where can they find you?
Instagram's the best. That I manage myself, and then which is at Jove Meyer. Otherwise, our website, jovemeyerevents.com, which is where the Ally Pledge lives front and center. It's literally the first thing on there. We're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, all the things. We're everywhere.
Right on. All right. Now, to end the podcast, I always do a lightning round.
Ooh.
So we're going to do a quick lightning round.
Oh my gosh.
Of questions.
Just got nervous.
This was inspired by one of our listeners, Leandre Pierre.
Oh, Leandre.
So shout out, Leandre Pierre. Let's start the lightning round. Aliens come to Earth. You can only give them one snack food, and they have to enjoy that snack food or they will destroy Earth. What snack food do you give them?
Chicken nuggets.
Chicken nuggets. McDonald's chicken nuggets?
Yes, the boot-shaped ones.
Specifically
the boot-shaped
okay,
ones.
Okay. You are at See's Candy. All of the candies are poisoned except for one candy, and you have to choose one that you're just going to roll the dice and eat. Which one do you eat?
Scotch Mallow, for sure.
Scotch Mallow?
Yes.
That's the one. You're rolling
yes,
the dice?
Always, every day.
Okay. Last question. Who would win in a versus battle? Whitney Houston or Dolly Parton?
Ooh. Whitney Houston.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, you heard it here first, people. Whitney Houston.
Yeah, I love them both, for the record.
Yeah.
But Whitney's musical talent, her vocals are more... They hit my heart in a different way. I love Dolly, but she doesn't emotionally hit me the way Whitney does.
I think one of the only times I ever cried during the national anthem was Whitney Houston's national anthem. Yeah. Best of all time.
Yeah. She's iconic.
Yeah. All right. It was good talking.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.